This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 70. That's 70 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Zachary Frühling. Today, we're going to be discussing Cardassian virtue ethics. Zachary, how are you doing there in California, my friend?
I'm doing great. You know, it hardly seems possible. Every time we hit an iteration of 10, like 60 or 70, I'm amazed. Like, wow, it's another milestone. We're on this mad march to doing 100 episodes of Metatrex.
Yeah, I can hardly believe. That's I had to say 70 just to let
Not
it sink
17,
in.
70.
70. It's hard to believe that, on average, I think our episodes generally run about an hour and 30 minutes, some a little more, some a little less, but an hour and 30 minutes each episode, 70 episodes, that's a lot of content out there talking about philosophy through the lens of Star Trek. It's incredible.
Yeah, I was kind of doing the math. That's over 100 hours of us talking about Star Trek and philosophy. And that is way more talking about philosophy than people would get if they were sitting in one of my old lectures when I was teaching philosophy in an entire semester, an entire year.
We were just talking in the Turbo Lift about our wonderful listeners and how much we appreciate the investment that they make into listening. I still find it amazing that anyone would sit down and listen to anything that I have to say. And so I'm just amazed. I want to say thank you to our listeners out there and just let you know, hopefully to your delight, that Zachary and I both feel that we have barely scratched the surface of what there is to explore in the Star Trek universe as it pertains to philosophy.
I think having our own show, Metatrex, has been amazing in terms of the intellectual freedom we get to dive into whatever issues we want to talk about. Inside the politics of philosophy as an academic discipline, there's all kinds of infighting, honestly. People who agree or disagree about different ways of doing philosophy, you know, different claims about what properly counts as philosophy and doesn't properly count as philosophy. And I have 100% completely lost interest in that debate. while there are some qualitative differences between other disciplines, like say cultural anthropology or sociology or psychology and philosophy, there are genuine qualitative differences there. I'm not interested in the minutiae of what different people think of as, in terms of philosophical methodology or what topics count as philosophy. This show has given us the freedom to go where we want to go and talk about the issues that we want to talk about. And that has been very empowering. And the same for you. You know, if you're listening to this and you sort of go, well, this doesn't sound like philosophy to me, but it sounds like an interesting topic, run with it, you know, go along on the journey and, you know, debate the issues and think about whatever topics you find interesting. You are, after all, the Gul Dukat of your own philosophical thought.
Indeed. And that's a perfect segue, Zachary, into today's topic. We're going to be talking about Cardassian virtue ethics. This has become a little bit of a series for us. We didn't expect it. We first talked about Klingon virtue ethics, and then we expanded beyond that and had a conversation a while back about Ferengi virtue ethics. And so we decided that next on the docket would be Cardassian virtue ethics. And I don't know, maybe sometime down the road, we'll get to the Romulans or some other interesting species out there in the Star Trek universe. We can sit and explore their bent on ethics.
Oh, I was thinking about this in the sonic shower this morning before we started recording. And I do have this worry that every time we talk about a certain race in Star Trek and their virtue ethics, that it doesn't really count as philosophy. I was only half jokingly saying I'm not interested in this anymore. I do have this worry because in the history of philosophy, philosophers have been generally more concerned with what objectively and universally counts as a correct or proper ethical view. And they're less interested in the fact of the matter about what individual people or individual cultures happen to think about ethics, right? The deeper question is, well, are they really right or wrong? Is that a good way to think about ethics or a bad way to think about ethics? So you could say that these discussions about virtue ethics as it relates to a particular race or species in Star Trek is more like cultural anthropology and less like philosophy. On the other hand, the very concept of virtue comes from Aristotle, and it comes from the history of philosophy, the notion that character traits are relevant to morality. So in my mind, I'm genuinely not interested in the issue anymore of whether this counts as philosophy. I happen to find it interesting. I think in looking at other races and what we think about their ethics inside the Star Trek universe, that serves as a mirror to ourselves and helps us evaluate better who we are as a people and what virtues we want to accept. So I find it philosophically interesting. And if you do too, that's okay. If other people don't, if you're an academic philosopher out there and you're listening to this and you go, that's not philosophy, this is cultural anthropology, I would say have some patience, come with us on the journey. You are the Legate Damar of your trek through the stars.
Well, and Zachary, we've been debating in philosophical realms for eons the nature of ethics in our world and in Star Trek and other worlds. And so I don't think there's any greater debate within the Star Trek universe than one of ethics and comparing and contrasting and juxtaposing different species throughout the Star Trek universe. I find it incredulous to think that there are fans out there who just don't find these ethical conversations, these ethical discussions, stimulating in some way or another, because Star Trek is so rich with episodes that really dissect and compare these ethical ideas throughout the Star Trek universe between species, the Federation compared to the Romulan Star Empire, and so on and so forth. These are the kinds of shows that really put Star Trek on the map to make it something that was unique from anything else out there that was being produced in terms of science fiction or television as a whole. You know, these interesting philosophical, ethical debates that happen within the Star Trek universe. And so I think it's very Star Trek for us to have these conversations and again compare and contrast. It's just unbelievable to me. And I'm not saying that there are fans or listeners out there who don't find, I mean, if you enjoy the epic space battles and the pew pew, that's great. I'm glad that you're a Star Trek fan, but for me, I find it intellectually stimulating. I find these ethical debates interesting. And these are the things that draw me to Star Trek as opposed to, you know, anything else out there that may be on TV.
Well, all of us, whether we recognize it or not, have to decide who we are. You know, we all have to ask the question, who am I? What defines me as a person? What character traits should I try to cultivate? What values should I hold? And we have to decide that as individuals, we have to decide it as societies. And if we're not thinking about it actively, then those decisions are being made by other people who have thought about it before you and are telling you, here's what you should find valuable, here's what you should be, here's what you should become. So part of my interest is in getting people who haven't really been self-reflective about who they are and what their values should be and what they want out of life and these kind of defining attributes that are virtuous to some degree, whether for some purpose or just intrinsically. I want people to think about it introspectively and make those decisions for themselves rather than society forcing those decisions on us, because there are so many pressures from outside about who we are and who we should be and what we should find valuable and what we should prioritize. And it's much more valuable to think about that as individuals and self-reflectively as a people together. But in terms of how it relates to the Star Trek universe, it's an interesting question to me. Can we learn anything about who we are and what we should value from looking at other races in the Star Trek universe? Can we learn something about human virtue ethics from looking at Romulan virtue ethics? Can we learn something about human virtue ethics from looking at the Ferengi virtue ethics? Can we learn something about ourselves here today in asking the question, what do Cardassians value about themselves and who are they as a people and what do they find virtuous?
I think that's what's so interesting and so fascinating about these various alien species that we encounter in the Star Trek universe, because they are just small snippets of our own nature. You referred to, you know, a mirror for us to look into that reflects, you know, back upon us, our own nature, our own ideas. And I think there is a great deal to be learned, even though, for instance, we're talking about Cardassians. So Cardassians can be rather cookie cutter in terms of, you know, all Cardassians are alike, they're all sneaky or whatever, you know, whatever attribute you want to give them. Cardassians have this tendency to be very cookie cutter, as many of the species in the Star Trek universe are. But they represent one aspect of humanity, one aspect of what we can be and sometimes are. And it's great to be able to look in that mirror and reflect, for lack of a better way of putting it. And so I think that these kinds of discussions are very important to have. I think it's important for us to look at these different species and mine from them what makes them great or what makes them evil, and consider what ramifications that has on us as a human species. What can we learn? How can we grow as a result? What attribute can we mine or discard as a result of examining ourselves through the lens of these various species?
Mike, I'm a mirror for you as well.
Well, I'm looking through that glass darkly, Zachary.
There's your Star Trek Nemesis reference of the day. As I was thinking about the Cardassians in particular, I was reflecting on the difference we see between Cardassians when they're introduced in Star Trek The Next Generation versus what we see in Deep Space Nine. And it occurred to me there are just some fundamental differences. The Cardassians that we see in TNG, there are certainly political tensions. It's clear that we can't trust the Cardassians because they're arming for war again. On the other hand, when we look at individual characters that we see, whether it's Gul-Masset or his aides that are on the Enterprise, they seem like very decent, respectable people. They seem to have care for life. They seem to regret the actions the Cardassian people have taken as a whole. They're very kind of pacified compared to the scheming, more cunning Cardassians that we see in Deep Space Nine. So as I start thinking about character traits that define Cardassians as a people, typify or stereotype Cardassians, I struggle a little bit with that because it seems like we get two very different versions of Cardassians in those two different shows.
We do. When we first meet Cardassians, they're, to some degree, I think, a lot like the Klingons. They're very militaristic in that way. And it wasn't until we got Deep Space Nine that we got still a militaristic society. The Cardassians, at least when we first meet them in Deep Space Nine, are still very militaristic. But we see a more... And isn't that true in life? When we meet someone for the first time, we draw a conclusion based on the version of them that we saw in that brief encounter. And it's only until you get to know somebody that you really start to discover that they are more rounded. I know I have met people in life and I have drawn conclusions based on whatever brief encounter that I had with them, but it, you know, once I got to know them better, I discover that there is much more to them. There are many facets to who they are, and I think the same was true with the Cardassians.
Well, I don't want to be accused of racially profiling the Cardassians. On the other hand, I do think there are character traits that define their culture in general, regardless of what we see in the variation from individual to individual inside Star Trek.
But it's funny, Zachary, you make an interesting point, and it's something that I think bears at least a brief discussion. You talked about racial profiling, and we live in a society today where, you know, that's something that we talk a great deal about. Not so much in the early 1990s when Deep Space Nine first came out. This wasn't something that we talked a great deal about. But it's interesting to me how the physical appearance of the Cardassians really inform the viewer about at least something about who they are. They're very snake-like. They with their necks, they look like cobras. They have this sort of smooth, scaly skin, and there's something, again, very snake-like about them. And I think that really informs the viewer a little bit about who they are. Certainly, when you see them, you're not engendered to trust them in any way.
I'm glad you thought to talk about their physical appearance. I'm not worried so much about their physical features per se, their biological physical features, but I'm talking mainly their culture, like the way their uniforms are configured. Mm-hmm. Right, their uniforms are configured for, I would call, maximum vertical stability. Those really rigid breastplates that keep the wearer as erect and upright as possible. Mm-hmm. And I think this is an interesting complexity to the Cardassian worldview. The Cardassians are not just scheming and cunning. They're certainly willing to do terribly horrendous things. Even in Star Trek The Next Generation, we see Captain Picard getting tortured by Gul Madred. So there's a sense in which Cardassians are not the most compassionate people. They are 100% willing to turn a blind eye to the suffering of others for their own purposes. On the other hand, even Gul Madred talks about the great cultural achievements and artistic achievements of the Cardassian people before they became a warlike people. And there's a kind of nobility. I mean, the fact that they are so upright in their uniforms, they view themselves as, I would say, as noble people, even given their moral failings.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that particular episode, that wonderful two-parter from The Next Generation, Chain of Command. A couple of things that I find fascinating about at least this particular Cardassian. You're right. They view themselves as many cultures do. Here in the United States, we talk about American exceptionalism as though we were in some way superior to any other nation or culture. And what I find fascinating about that, at least in terms of America, we've only been around just a little over a couple of hundred years, and there are nations and cultures who have existed much, 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 much longer than that. And so I think there is this tendency for cultures, for societies, for nations, and in the Star Trek universe, for species to view themselves in some way superior. And that's certainly true for the Cardassians. Whether they are or not, I think that's relative. I think that's subjective. I think that's something that remains to be seen. You know, whether they did or they didn't. The Klingons are the same way, talking about, for instance, one of my favorite lines, you can never appreciate Shakespeare until you've read it in the original Klingon. You know, there's this need to believe that they're in some way superior. And it's interesting to me, and one of the things that I want to touch on as we go through our discussion is the way the Cardassians are very family-oriented, and for him to display human suffering to his child as something to look upon, to pity, and something to base that child's own sense of superiority on, I find that very fascinating. That's a great episode to invoke.
A few years ago, I remember seeing a documentary on body language, and this was a very fascinating documentary. And one of the things they showed President George W. Bush walking through a garden alongside President Vladimir Putin in Russia. And their body language was completely different. and basically the speaker in the documentary was making the claim that you can learn a lot about values and political relationships and how people view themselves in relation to others from their body language. George W. Bush had this very almost Cardassian walk. He was taller and more rigid and more confident than Vladimir Putin. And Vladimir Putin, he had more of this sort of swarmy, swarthier kind of walk, and it wasn't as confident to American eyes. And of course, it looks totally different from the Russian perspective, right? They view themselves in the same way, and they just view, prioritize different outward expressions of what is probably the same view, this sort of nationalistic superiority. And I think we all do this, right? I think we all have this deep-seated need to be a little bit better than other people. And it's sad that that's true, but I think it is true. And I caught myself, I mean, this is confession time. I caught myself doing that just this morning. I went to the donut shop this morning to get some donuts. And I was in a room full of people. It was a little crowded in there. And I was taller than everyone in there. There were a bunch of short people in there. And I caught myself just kind of standing just a little bit taller. I went into Cardassian mode right there inside the donut shop. And I think we're all like that as individuals. Societies can be like that. I think that is embodied in the way that the Cardassians present themselves outward to others.
I think it's interesting that you say that, Zachary, because I have always been taken aback by the swagger of Gul Dukat. No matter what the situation is, he has this certain swagger that says, I know that I'm superior to everyone in this room. And I always found that fascinating. Even when he's down on his luck, even when things aren't going well for him, with the exception of a couple of scenes that I can think of, you know, for instance, after he kind of has his mental breakdown after the death of his daughter, I found him to be arrogant, and it showed in the way that he carried himself. And I think again, you're right, that rigid uniform that he wore really just accentuates that. It holds him erect, and then you add to it the swagger, the, you know, that cocky walk that, and I'm sure it's a little bit of the actor bringing that to the character. I don't know if that was something written into the character, but it was brought to life so well by the way the actor portrayed the character.
We might be in the realm of sophistry as opposed to philosophy at this point, but there is something to this notion that how you present yourself goes a long way towards explaining how you're perceived and how your words are received. I mean, think about the captains we see in Star Trek, whether it's Sisko or whether it's Picard or Captain Kirk. There's the way that they carry themselves when they're walking around their ship or sitting on the bridge commands respect, right? There's a confidence to it that they all have. And part of it's because they're in the center seat, and it just being in the center seat conveys that authority. But there's a difference between Captain Picard sitting in the center seat versus Wesley Crusher sitting in the center seat, right? Captain Picard has cultivated that kind of those mannerisms and that outward way of presenting yourself that commands respect and commands authority. I had to do this as a teacher, right? When I discovered, really, like first person experience, when I first started teaching, that when I walked into a classroom, there's a kind of respect that comes along with it, but the way you present yourself when you're there goes a long, long way towards explaining how people perceive you and what you do with that respect. You know, I think there's a reason that, like, when you go to, like, corporate training, you know, like, how to do corporate public speaking, you know, they always tell you to, like, you know, okay, keep your hands centered, you know, put your hands together in a certain way, keep your fingers together, mm-hmm. keep them about waist high, make sure you do certain kinds of gestures, because those things command respect. Bill Clinton was the best at this. Look at the way Bill Clinton back in the day used to kind of clench his fist and kind of shake it outward. He had a certain mannerism that commanded authority. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't like him, you didn't like those mannerisms, maybe. The Cardassians have mastered a certain way of presenting themselves that portray them in a certain light. I don't think they have the quiet confidence of Captain Picard or even Captain Kirk sitting with his, you know, legs crossed and his arms rested casually in the center seat of the Enterprise. It's a little bit forced. I'm thinking of the first time we see Gul Dukat physically in Emissary in Deep Space Nine, the first episode of Deep Space Nine, when he comes into what is now Sisko's office and he is kind of propping himself up, walking around saying, this was my office 2 weeks ago. And he's mm-hmm. trying to stand as tall as he can possibly stand compared to, and Sisko is sitting casually commanding the desk in his chair, owning the office.
Excuse my presumption, but this was my office only 2 weeks ago.
And it's definitely a kind of vaudeville act of outperforming each other. You know, one person standing as tall as can possibly be to command authority, and Sisko sitting casually behind his desk to command authority. It's a power play. I find that fascinating.
It is. You're exactly right. It is a power play, Zachary. And I think that it's fascinating to me because the way, at least in this case, the Cardassians carry themselves, I think informs something of their ethical positions, or at least how they view themselves ethically. They see themselves as a noble race, as a superior race, and so they carry themselves as such. And again, that's kind of getting into the nuts and bolts of their ethical position as a species. But I think that's all reflected in the way they carry themselves.
And I want to be careful here because I don't think it's total smoke and mirrors. We do learn that the Cardassians are one of the more cultured races that we see in Certainly. Star Trek. So there's something to that nobility. They've earned it in some way. But they're looking at it kind of retrospectively. They were a very noble people, and now they've become a warlike people. Kind of like the fall of Rome looking backward on itself, right? You know, mm-hmm. the great achievements of Cardassians past, and they're trying to live up to this vision of themselves that is a remnant of their prior selves.
Yeah, it's interesting because when we meet them, they're sort of trying to reclaim their cultural relevance. They are trying to reclaim some sense of that superiority that they once had as a species, but they're doing it in a universe that is changing.
You know, I'm probably obsessing about this a little more than I should, but I find it genuinely fascinating because I have been in positions where I know that my outward expression, my body language, has conveyed the fact that the thing I'm listening to is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Like, I will catch myself with my arms folded, my legs crossed, leaned back in my chair, furrowed brow, looking like a shark. And, you know, if there's something that is just getting my back up, you know, I don't have to say a word to convey that I think you're an idiot. and there's a power to that. It can be used. It can be misused. It can be kind and it can be mean. But there's definitely a command presence that you can cultivate if you pay attention to how you're presenting yourselves. You can speak volumes non-verbally if you cultivate those character traits and those skills.
Zachary, is it times like those that you whip out your good old standard Cardassian neck trick?
Yeah, just it's like, boom, just out goes my neck.
I mean, I can see you sitting there with your arms folded, your bulging feet at out, crossed, furrowed brow, and then all of a sudden, boom,
like
there,
the Hulk?
There goes
like,
the Cardassian
like,
neck.
I'm like the Hulk, rather than like beefing up, my neck goes kapoof.
Skin turns gray. Yes, yes.
And it's funny because I actually feel like I got this from my grandmother. And I don't want to say a bad word about my grandma Fruling because she was the kindest person. I mean, she taught me so much about life. But she was a teacher and she could give you a look of death as a teacher. And I totally inherited that from her.
My daughter calls that a dad look. I have one of those as well. That's dad look.
Now, I think the difference is that, like, we're talking about Gul Dukat versus Captain, or at that point, Commander Sisko in Emissary when they're mm-hmm. having this power play inside of Sisko's office. I get the sense, and I think this is progressively true over the course of Deep Space Nine, that Gul Dukat has to try harder and harder and harder to maintain the illusion about himself.
Certainly. And isn't that true in real life as well? The more you get to know someone, if you're trying to maintain, if you're trying to express a certain quality of yourself, if you're trying to portray yourself to somebody in a certain light. I think about dating relationships, and I'm going in the way back machine here, you know, to go back to the days when I was dating, and we've all done this. We try to portray ourselves in a certain way, to present ourselves, you know, confidently, securely, and we try to be the best version of ourselves on a date. But, you know, the first date becomes a second date and a third date and so on and so forth. As we go along, it's a little bit harder to portray ourselves the way we did on that first date. The nuances of our personality and sometimes our faults, they tend to come to the surface. And so it's more and more, I'm not comparing the relationship between Dukat and Sisko as a dating relationship, but I think there's something to be said as we get to know people a little bit better. This is true, Zachary, of you and I, although you and I, we've never met in person. We've gotten to know each other, I think, pretty well, over the course of the last couple of years as we've been doing MetaTreks. And certainly I see you differently now than I did when we first started doing these. And I've learned more about you as you have me. And for that matter, I think it has made the relationship something richer. And I think in the case of Dukat and Sisko, as they got to know each other better and better, I think they respected one another. You know, and I, again, the final iteration of Ducat aside, where he was just stark raving mad, I think prior to that, there was a respect that Sisko seemed to have for Gul Dukat, in so much that, you know, when he's in that prison cell and he is just kind of a blabbering idiot because he's had a mental breakdown, Sisko was sad to see him like that. He had come to respect him, and, you know, to see him like that, he was compassionate. He was sorry to see him that way. And I thought that was very interesting.
I think as I look back on my own life so far, I can see that my extremes have become more extreme over time. You know, there are times when I'm genuinely a genuine person. And I think as I get older, that genuineness comes through in purer ways than it did when I was younger. On the other hand, I have drunk my own Kool-Aid for so long that there are illusions about myself that I maintain and propagate and self-perpetuate. Mm-hmm. And reality is somewhere in the middle. I also seem to just care less about what other people think about those things. As I get older, I just care less about, you know, what other people think. And that, I think that's just normal. I think we're all mostly like that as we get older. But for all of those features for me have become extremes. And as I look at Cardassians, I think I keep going back to this question we've asked whenever we do one of these virtue ethics episodes. And it's because it's been an issue in human virtue ethics. There's this question historically of the ideal human, the ideal individual, and different time periods and different cultures have had different things to say about this. In Christianity, Jesus would be the ideal individual. Mm-hmm. Like in philosophy, you might point to someone like Socrates as the ideal philosopher. Mm-hmm. You know, individual cultures have their own vision about what an ideal human would be. So
the Ubermensch.
The Ubermensch. Yeah, absolutely. So the notion of an ideal person who maximizes and typifies all of the values that a culture prizes is intimately related to this question of virtue ethics. Because if you start asking the question, which values do we prioritize? You can ask yourself, well, what if someone had all of these values and they were, you know, to the greatest possible degree, what would that kind of person be like? So whenever you start talking about virtues, you tend towards wanting to talk about the ideal typification of those virtues. And we've done this before. We've mentioned that Worf, for example, with Klingons is like the idealized Klingon in some sort of platonic sense. That's how he views himself, at least. You know, with Ferengi, who did we say about the Ferengi? is Quark the ideal Ferengi? I don't know.
I don't know. That's,
I don't know about
that.
That's an open question. But I, you know,
I think in their society, though, it would be the Grand Negus is considered to be the ideal Ferengi.
It's supposed to be. Yeah. Yeah. Suppose it's how it's perceived, at least. But with the Cardassians, I think as I look back at Deep Space Nine, I would have said that Gul Dukat early in Deep Space Nine is the ideal Cardassian. He's confident. He commands power. He is in charge, or was in charge, is in charge of a great many things. There's a confidence that's projected. There's a subtlety to him. I know he's definitely clued into the subtlety of interpersonal relationships, and he knows how to manipulate. So he's scheming, but he has that nobility. So I would point to him as a very good candidate for a typical Cardassian. Yeah, idealized typical Cardassian. On the other hand, you know, in the course of Deep Space Nine, I think he blows it a lot. And by the end of Deep Space Nine, I actually look at Legate Damar as being a lot more authentic as a Cardassian by the very end of Deep Space Nine, when we're in the middle of the sort of Cardassian liberation movement at the end of Deep Space Nine than Gul Dukat was at the beginning of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, I agree. And it's wonderful that we have characters that we were able to get to know from the species, not to the degree that we got to know the Bajoran people, but, you know, think about this. We had Gul Dukat, we had Damar, we had Garak, we had Legate Gamor. These are Cardassian characters that we got to know to some degree, some more than others. But I think these characters really show us different aspects of the Cardassian people and who they are ethically. Legate Gamor, for instance, teaches us how valuable family is in how much the Cardassian people value their family. Their family is everything, and a man would go to great lengths to protect his family. And we see some contradictions to that. Garrick, for instance, we discover that a man would do anything for the state. That seems to be Garrick's position, as he and Dr. Bashir are debating some Cardassian literature, you know, the extent that a man would go for the state. But Legate Gamorre, for instance, is willing to betray the state for his daughter.
Well, Captain Picard points out the inherent tension that he sees inside Gul Madred's approach to what he exposes his own daughter to. Mm-hmm. He clues into the fact that he cares deeply about his own daughter. That's clear inside the episode, right? They don't make any effort to, you know, make it seem like he's a hard-hearted person who doesn't care about his own family even, right? He's a family man in a way. Mm-hmm. And yet he exposes his daughter to all of the torture that he's doing with Captain Picard. And Captain Picard says, "I'm surprised you let your daughter see this." And it just points out the fact that the Cardassians don't perceive the tension in and the inherent contradiction in how they view themselves as, you know, loving family people who are okay with torture and de-Cardassianizing others.
Something else, Zachary, I want to throw out on the table, kind of shifting gears here a little bit. In the Deep Space Nine episode Tribunal, we discover something about Cardassian culture, and that is the value they place. And I mentioned this in my previous statement about Legate Gamorre and Garrick. The role that the state plays in Cardassian society. This is a society that, you know, ethically are very in tune to the needs of the many. The state is everything. And this culture draws a great deal of security from their position within the state. And we find out that the justice system, for instance, is designed not to produce justice, but rather to give the people a sense of security through theater rather than the disposition of justice. And it's interesting to me because that episode, Tribunal, actually came out about a week before my wife and I were married. And that was, my wife and I got married on OJ Day. We were married June the 12th, 1994. I remember going to the hotel room and turning on the television and seeing that white Bronco chase happening. And
OJ Day, that's hilarious.
Yes. Yes. So it wasn't very difficult for me to remember my anniversary, at least up until about 10 years. After 10 years, they stopped doing all the documentaries. You know, at that time, we stopped really acknowledging it every single year. You know, the week before June the 12th, you know, we would kind of revisit the OJ Nicole Brown thing and Ron Goldman. And so in the years that followed, we got this theater that unfolded in reality television. And I think it's almost prophetic. I mean, we had, you know, court cases that were televised on TV, but not to the extent that the OJ trial was. I mean, millions of people and people all over the world tuned in to this theater that was the OJ Simpson trial. And before that murder ever happened, we had this episode, Tribunal, that really cued us into something that I find very fascinating about the Cardassian people, and that is the security that they get through what they perceive, at least, as the dispensation of justice, but is nothing more than theater.
Well, I think you're onto something in terms of how the Cardassians view themselves in relation to the state. Almost more than the Klingons view themselves as part of the Empire, the Cardassians view themselves as a Cardassian in the sense of I'm part of the Cardassian state, as mm-hmm. opposed to a Cardassian as an individual. Klingons still have this kind of rugged individuality, like the notion of their own personal honor. Whereas Cardassians seem to really embrace the notion that they are part of the Cardassian political structure. And that defines them as an individual almost more than for any other race in Star Trek, I think. You know, the Romulans are like that to some degree, but the Romulans are conniving as individuals and Klingons have their personal honor and Vulcans are too rational to care about such things. But the Cardassians, they are part of the Cardassian state. It speaks directly to the heart of individualism versus communalism. I'm also glad you thought to mention Garrick, because I think Garrick does typify something that is very interesting about Cardassians. The Cardassian theater that you mentioned, the political shows and their show trials and whatnot, and even the outward confidence that Gul Dukat projects, is something of an illusion. It's a bit of smoke and mirrors, and Garrick understands that the real power happens behind the scenes in shadows. So Garrick, I think he really enjoys being moving in the shadows in full display for all to see, and that tension between being totally visible and yet moving quietly in the real power structure behind the scenes. I think power structures are really like that. There's all this outward theater we get in politics here in the real world, but the real power happens quietly in the shadows.
Yeah, and I think it gets back to something that I said earlier about the appearance of the Cardassians. I'm really hesitant to draw any conclusions about the Cardassians based on their appearance. But again, I think in the Star Trek universe that their appearance really informs something about them. And I think this snake-like look that they have, Garrick really typifies, personifies that snake-like way of kind of slithering around in the shadows and really kind of in plain sight, but more subtle than any other character in the Star Trek universe.
Plain, simple Garrick would be the first to say that the clothes make the Cardassian.
And that sounds like something that you would find on his reality show, Keeping Up with the Cardassians.
Well, he is a tailor, after all. But there's something to that. You know, you dress a little differently, project yourself in a certain way, and you can become the thing that you're trying to project, you know, because you put yourself in the right environment, because you've, clothed yourself in a certain way. Those things are deeply tied to our identity in a way that I recognize now that I didn't when I was younger.
You know, Zachary, I had mentioned a few moments ago, you know, this book that Garrick and Bashir were discussing that I think is an interesting little nugget that gives us a bit of a window into Cardassian society. And the book that Garrick had recommended to Bashir was a book called The Never Ending Sacrifice. It was a Cardassian novel that Garrick thought was, you know, quote, the finest Cardassian novel ever written, end quote. It was a repetitive epic, he called it, in Cardassian literature. And it described seven generations of a Cardassian family, all of whom lived completely selfless lives devoted to the state. And again, I think that's very interesting to see that this idea of being devoted to the state, to being part of the state, to sacrifice not just yourself, but your family, you know, and handing that down seven generations in the Never-Ending Sacrifice, seven generations of this family that were just devoted selflessly to the state. I think that's a very interesting window into Cardassian society and into Cardassian virtue ethics that I think is worthy of a little discussion.
Wait, the Never-Ending Sacrifice, isn't that the one where the protagonist Atreyu sacrifices his own horse to fight the nothing for the good of the Cardassian state? I read that book. I grew up in the 80s. I read that one.
I just want to break out into never-ending story.
Never-ending sacrifice. No, it's the never-ending sacrifice. I sing more on Metatrex than I ever thought I would.
Somehow I see Garrick on the back of a flying dragon that looks more like a dog.
Yeah, yeah. What was the name of that dragon? The luck. It was a luck dragon, right?
Luck dragon. Yeah.
Yeah. What's the Cardassian equivalent of a luck dragon?
It's a Galar class luck dragon, Zachary. We've got to get this right. Yeah, I can totally see Garrick on the back of a luck dragon, you know, with his fist in the air. Woohoo! But I do. I think it's a fascinating window into this idea, this value that they place on the state and the role that the state plays in Cardassian society.
And that doesn't sit well with American audiences, I think, frankly, because even at our most collectivist, we still have a great suspicion of authority and government in this country, even for people who claim to be communalists. I think there is this deep-seated individualism and skepticism of authority. We don't like complete 100% sacrifice for the good of the state in this country. We're more individualistic than that.
Yeah, and I think to some degree the Cardassians are a commentary about that. Certainly we see that in the Klingon society, we see that with the Romulans, but really no more so than I think we draw that conclusion with the Cardassians, especially in Deep Space Nine. I think there's some commentary in there that the writers gave us that says we shouldn't trust the state to such a degree. And it's interesting how it contrasts the Federation more so than probably any other society that we get within the Star Trek universe.
The Federation is communalist and collectivist, mm-hmm. largely, but it contrasts to a great degree with the Cardassian Empire.
It does, to an incredible degree. And I don't think that's an accident. I really think it's a commentary, a warning almost, for the Star Trek viewer to be wary of that kind of power and control given to the state in a society. And I think the tribunal is almost prophetic in a way, because I think it says something for, again, this idea that the justice system can fearfully become more theater than something that dispenses justice.
Well, a cunning politician could use the name of safety and security for political gain and for his own or her own power purposes, right? And ever since we've had September 11th in this country, safety and security, even when it's not based on any kind of reality, that mm-hmm. becomes the narrative that if you trust me, I will make you safe. I will make you secure. I'll keep you safe from the terrorists, in scare quotes, right? And so I think the story of the last 16 years in this country has been using safety for political purposes, for whether it's genuine or whether it's manufactured.
Yeah. And I think, frankly, it's been going on much longer than
Yeah. And it's not like these are new issues. These issues go all the way back to the beginning of our country and, frankly, the history of the world, in all fairness. But if you remember the famous Benjamin Franklin quote, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." Mm. Even then, 240 some odd years ago, they were worried about people abusing the narrative of safety and security for political purposes to the detriment of individual liberty.
Yeah, and we certainly see that among the Cardassians, even in flashback episodes, when we get to kind of go back in time and see Deep Space Nine when it was Tarak Nor, the power that the Cardassians held over the Bajorans who worked there on Tarak Nor, who were basically, for all intents and purposes, slaves on Tarak Nor. There was this sense of, we are providing safety, we are providing protection, we are providing security for you. And this quote that Gul Dukat uses kind of over and over and over again, this phrase that he says, "Rest assured," he always says, even in his computer recording, when Deep Space Nine's security protocols are enacted, and basically the space station's on lockdown, and all of these security measures are enacted to try to eliminate any kind of Bajoran uprising. There's this recorded message where Gul Dukat says, "Rest assured, your deaths are going to." He's trying to comfort them by saying, "Rest assured, your deaths are going to ensure that something like this never happens."
I know there's a group of people out there for whom irony is totally lost. So rest assured, I'm saying this ironically, but there is a way of saying a phrase like this: "You should be thankful for your life as a slave because we're providing you with so much security."
And that's kind of the attitude, honestly, within that society on Tarak Nor. There is that sense of arrogance that says, for instance, you know, when the Cardassians take, you know, these comfort women, and they should be thankful that they were chosen and that they're being provided for and that their rations are being increased for their families. They're sex slaves, for Pete's sake.
It's also very, very similar to George Orwell's 1984, right? Big Dukat is watching you. You know, the all-powerful state keeps an eye on everything. Everyone has security, but no one has autonomy.
And again, it's not just their clothes, Zachary, but look at the construction of Deep Space Nine. You have that whole upper deck where you always see Cardassians kind of walking around, looking down upon the Bajarans in the promenade. Look at Ops, the way, and they even say as much in the first episode, Emissary. Sisko notices, he makes note of, he talks about, you know, the way that Ops is created. So, you know, here's the office up here where, you know, the Cardassian overlord can look down on everyone else in Ops. It's reflected in their architecture, for
people. I'm so glad you thought to mention that, because I do have this ongoing developing interest in industrial design and manufactured objects and what messages the design of an object convey outwardly. I look around my podcast studio here and I see all of the manufactured objects. All of them were made by someone who wants to convey some sort of message to me as a consumer who bought all of them, right? But they convey certain values, you know, the way, you know, think of like the way Apple designs their products to be sleek and clean. And it's very Federation-like, actually, you know, mm-hmm. the way Apple designs their products, you know, the iPads people walking around the Enterprise D with their proto space iPads, versus Cardassian design, which conveys a very different set of values in the industrial design.
Yeah, I find that interesting as well. And it's incredibly fascinating to me the way Cardassian architecture is so unique with...
Well, it's not democratic.
No, but it's just these spires.
I'm glad you thought to mention the spires, because I think their architecture, from the architecture of Deep Space Nine to what we see of the cities in Cardassia Prime, we see a very sort of tall, I think erect is the right word for it, honestly. You know, they strive towards greatness, and that mm-hmm. shows in all of their architecture and the spires. I mean, here in America, we build, we build towers and we build bridges and that speaks to our nobility. I think yes. there's a design philosophy that comes along with those things. And the Cardassians, in building with that architecture, you know, these tall spires that look down on everything else, that says something about their values. It's like the all-seeing eye up at the top of the Cardassian pinnacle.
Yeah, and that kind of superiority, that kind of power, that kind of self-image, I think, lends itself to this very corrupt society that we get in Deep Space Nine that is really on the precipice of breakdown. This society is on the edge. They're crumbling. I mean, right before our eyes, we see them crumble because they have these differing opinions. You have a faction that wants to hold on to the superiority that they had in the past, and you have another faction that kind of wants to move forward and not necessarily forget about the achievements of the past, but move forward and look ahead. And those two factions really cause the crumble of this society to the point that, unfortunately, the power falls to, you know, Gul Dukat, who is one of these kind of Cardassians who's clinging to his own superiority and the superiority of his culture, to the point that he signs a deal with the devil and seals the fate of his culture.
I'm wondering, Mike, if there's a bit of a parallel with us as an American society. You know, 50 to 60 years ago, we were building our infrastructure. We built the interstate mm-hmm. highway system. We were building towers and cities, modernizing cities. And then those got to a state of disrepair. And now there's kind of this resurgence of modernizing cities again, but it's all very corporate. And like here in San Francisco, you get the tech industry investing in buildings and infrastructure, but it's all centered around the tech industry driving prices up. But the rest of our infrastructure, this nationwide modern transportation and infrastructure system is largely in a state of disrepair. We haven't invested in it over the decades like we should have to maintain it. So we have this trajectory of having been very progressive for a period of decades, decade and a half or so in the 50s and 60s, where we built up this infrastructure. We became a truly modern country. And now the infrastructure that defined us as a people, this progressive infrastructure, is in a state of disrepair. It's in a state of decline because people aren't willing to invest in it like they were in the 50s and 60s. Are we similar to the Cardassians in this regard? Did we achieve a peak of greatness in, say, 50 years ago or 40 years ago that we have been declining from ever since?
And I think that's an interesting thought. And again, whether it is intentional or not, I think that the Cardassians can be a mirror of that on at least us as an American society. And I think there's a great warning in there for every nation, for every culture here on planet Earth. Because again, I think we've seen, we go back in history, this sort of thing happened to the Roman Empire. There was this internal decline. It wasn't an external threat that brought down the Roman Empire. It was an internal decline. And I think we've seen that pattern happen over and over and over throughout history, as I understand it. And so I think there is a commentary about that throughout the course of especially Deep Space Nine, but we get a little bit of it also in TNG.
Well, I think there's a very Star Trek message here, which is that if you don't keep striving to get better as an individual, as a society, you will get worse. How's that for pessimism on Metatrex? I try to be more optimistic than that because we really do have the power to put our heads together, solve problems, make the world a better place. You know, this is the core of the Star Trek message. We can become better than we are. But if we don't try, we will go right back to our baser instincts and we will become worse.
But I don't see that as pessimism at all. You're right. That is a very Star Trek message. And I think that's a message that we get, you know, directly and indirectly in the Star Trek universe. I mean, Quark says as much in Deep Space Nine. You know, he talks about how, you know, the humans are, you know, they're great, they're noble people, but you take away their creature comforts, you take away the you take these things away from them. And
take away their ractuccinos.
They are, you know, they're no different than any other, any other culture, any other society out there. And so I think we get that message directly and indirectly in the Star Trek universe. And we really see that with the Cardassians. I think they're a warning to us that we either seek to improve ourselves, we either seek to better ourselves, or, you know, we face decline. We face the possibility that we crumble as a society. And I don't see that as a pessimistic message, because you do have two alternatives. It's kind of a glass full, glass half full or glass half empty kind of scenario. It's all in the way you look at it. I choose to look at it as a very optimistic point of view, because we do have the power to better ourselves, to improve ourselves, to not go down that path, as long as we heed the warnings in terms of the real universe, our own history. But we can also look at this society, this Cardassian society, and this wonderful science fiction saga that we all love so much, and we can say we don't want to become that. And I think that's probably true of I can't imagine somebody saying, yes, I want to see our world become like Cardassia. No, that's not what we want to become.
Well, it's interesting because we're kind of walking this fine line between saying, look, all of us need to care more about our world and our society and making the sacrifices it takes to make our world a better world, right? That is essentially what you're saying the Cardassians are saying, sacrifice for the state. That is kind of what we're saying, that people have become unwilling to sacrifice for the greater good because we've become so inwardly focused. We're worried about the government taking our taxes or our guns or our whatever, that we're not willing to invest in the community at large and build the better world that really can genuinely exist if we're all willing to make some sacrifices.
But that's what I find fascinating about the Cardassians. Garrick speaks to the nobility of this Cardassian family, who for seven generations in the never-ending sacrifice gave all for the state. And yet we meet Cardassians like Gul Dukat, who they are willing to, at least on the surface, you know, give it all. I mean,
they'll benefit from other people's sacrifices. Yeah,
well, I mean, we see, for instance, we see him, you know, willing to sacrifice himself for this, you know, for this kind of provisional government, during the collapse of Cardassia. You know, he's become kind of the protector of the council, and, you know, he's willing to sacrifice himself to protect them. So we can say, oh, you know, Gul Dukat is that kind of person. He's willing to give all, you know, for the state, for the government as, you know, as it stands. But we also know that Gul Dukat is very opportunistic and very self-centered. He's looking for the opportunity to grab power. And that's the Gul Dukat that we see eventually emerge as we move along. So yes, I see Cardassia as that kind of state, the kind of state that we see, at least in the description that that Garrett gives us of the Neverending Sacrifice, but it is made up of people like Gul Dukat, who are willing to sacrifice for the state as long as it serves his own self-interest.
And who keeps letting Gul Dukat into the room anyway? He becomes a real screw up by the end of Deep Space Nine, and yet they keep letting him into all the important meetings.
Well, I think that's something that I find interesting, because
he has power even when he's a screw up. It's amazing.
Because he takes advantage of, and this is something that I've seen in the business world. I've seen people who are just complete screw ups who use relationship to kind of stay ahead of the game. He does this with Damar. Damar kind of owes him. You know, he was Damar's mentor, and Damar's a better Cardassian, I think, in the end than Gul Dukat ever was, certainly. But, you know, there's this point where, you know, Damar is now the man in power, but he's kind of a scrub himself. He's a drunk, and he's self-reflective, and he doesn't like what he sees in the mirror. But Gul Dukat is able to use that relationship to kind of keep his grip, at least to some degree, on what's going on in Cardassian society. And I think that's, I see that in the corporate world, where the wrong people just manage to keep their grip on things through the manipulation of relationship.
Yeah, this is something I find endlessly fascinating, and it speaks directly to the philosopher king paradox from Plato, right? I mean, this is an old problem, that the people who should be in charge and have real wisdom and real understanding don't have the ambition it takes generally to play the game enough to get to a position of power. Yet I'm constantly amazed in the business world, in the political realm, at the people who are, I don't want to say they're screw-ups, because they've played the game, right? They have learned to play the game, so they're successful, right? These are not screw-up people. But they don't have the depth of understanding, or the depth of commitment, or the wherewithal, or the beneficence of spirit to justify the position that they're in. It's very self-serving, and they've learned to play the game, so they're successful. They're not screw-ups, but they don't really deserve to be there.
Yeah.
And I've seen that happen again and again and again, with some exceptions. There are people I've run into, and I'm glad there are exceptions. There are a small handful of people I've known over the years that genuinely do have understanding and do have passion and do care about the good of what they do, and they are in positions of authority to various degrees. But it's a pretty small number compared to the what I would categorize as screw-ups who've managed to fake it until they've got to that position. Yeah, and if you're one of them out there and you're listening to this, I'm talking to you.
And I think that's fascinating, because we get both of those with Damar. When we first meet Damar, he's kind of an understudy of Dukat, and he's sort of hanging on to Dukat's coattails, and he is really given that power, and he doesn't deserve it. He hasn't earned it. He doesn't deserve it. He doesn't handle
and he knows
it, well.
It. He drinks it off with Kanar, right?
Yeah, he absolutely knows it. But there's a change that takes place in him, that when we see this uprising in Cardassian society, this liberation of Cardassia from the Dominion, Damar becomes somebody who is worthy of that power. He's worthy of the
leadership that he's been given, and the people want him to assume that lead. He becomes a bit of a legend. He's sort of a Robin Hood type figure in his own society. And we know that he deserves it because he truly gives his life for Cardassia. And it's a shame because that's how we know he deserves it. You know, we didn't really realize to the fullest extent that he deserves it until he's gone. And, you know, and it's kind of a shame really in the end, because he's become this ideal Cardassian, but now he's dead and there's no one to pick up that mantle. Unless, of course, you read the books, and then we kind of find out that, you know, Garrick really sort of becomes that one who picks up that mantle, and because of his time away from Cardassia, he becomes the ideal Cardassian.
Well, I think this is a lesson that we learned from Captain Kirk in the movie Generations. You know, Captain Kirk basically realizes that you don't get to sit in the center seat forever, right? While you're there, he says, you can make a difference.
Truly.
Don't let them do anything that takes you out of that chair. Stay on the bridge of the Enterprise. So when you're there, you can make a difference. But with that comes responsibility. You know, if you happen to be lucky enough to have figured out how to play the game to get yourself in a position of authority or a position of influence, you've got a responsibility to do some good with it. And if you don't, you're A, an idiot, and B, not living up to your full potential. And certainly there are external factors and constraints, and it's not easy to be in those roles. I get it. But you've got a responsibility to at least try to do some good. And I think, you know, Damar, he doesn't quite realize that about himself yet, that yes, he's been thrust into this position. He's not really qualified, but he's there. In fact, he's depressed about it. He knows he's not worthy of it. He's drinking his life away. And then by the end of Deep Space Nine, he's committed again, and he knows he can make a difference. He ends up sacrificing himself for it. But and there have been, like, in here in our country, there have been presidents like that. Like, I'm thinking of someone like, you know, Gerald Ford. You know, the most unlikely candidate to be president of the United States ends up becoming president of the United States. And there are a couple others like this in the history of our country. And, you know, what do? You know, they can wallow in it. They do their best to work within the constraints around them. You know, they succeed or not succeed to various degrees. But once you're there in that center seat, you've got a responsibility to do everything good you can possibly do with it. And if you don't try, it may not be successful, right? You know, lots of external constraints. But, you know, if you're not at least trying to make maximum use of the potential you've got in that position of authority, then you're an idiot. And, you know, all of us can wallow sometimes. I'm not making full use of my potential. I'm not doing what I want to do. I'm not making the impact I want to make. But we can always look in and go, you know, I'm here right now, and I'm going to do whatever I can to make the best world out of it, given all of these constraints. And if you don't have that attitude, you're not living up to your potential. And I think we see Damar kind of make that shift by the end of Deep Space Nine.
You mentioned Gerald Ford. I think Nixon's actually one of those presidents, Zachary. Here's a guy who really was willing to do anything and everything to get that power. He wanted to be president, and he was willing to do whatever it took to become president. You know, he squared off against Kennedy in 1960, and we all know how that went. But he held on, and he kept fighting, and eventually, you know, he becomes president, and he abuses power, and he ends up resigning from office. The only president to ever resign in the history of this country. He gave up the presidency because he knew he was facing impeachment. He knew that he would probably be removed from office, and so he resigns. But the greatest achievements of Richard Nixon didn't happen while he was trying to get power, even while he had it. It was after he left. I mean, he opened up the doors to the relationship that America had with China through the...
Only Nixon could go to China, Mike.
Only Nixon could go to China. And Star Trek acknowledges that. So here's a guy who, while he had the power, wasn't worthy of it. But after he lost the power, I think the man became worthy of it, and he played to his own strengths, and he did something that no other American was able to do, and that was to open the doors to China. And we remember him for that. So you mentioned Ford, so I give up Richard Nixon as an example of that.
I think one thing that we forget about each other all the time is that we all of us view ourselves as the hero of our own story. So
truly,
even people who don't deserve to be in a position of authority, or they're screwing it up, or they're faking it till they make it, or whatever, they've got a narrative they're telling about themselves, about all the great things they're doing.
Yeah. And the danger of that is to become a Descartes and really resign oneself to evil in order to achieve, you know,
whatever it is
that you desire to get. Descartes certainly was the hero of his own story, but unfortunately,
yes, he was.
He was so blinded by his own self-interest that he truly resigned himself to evil in order to achieve it.
Well, I think in the interest of wrapping up the show and talking about final thoughts, I am constantly intrigued by this inherent tension that I see in the Cardassians. On the one hand, they have a great history and a great culture. Historically, there's a nobility that comes along with that historical awareness and also with how they view themselves. They view themselves as standing tall, you know, maybe looking down on everyone else, but I'm trying to emphasize more of the standing tall part, right? They view themselves as noble people. And yet they are willing to do some pretty terrible, morally terrible things in the name of reinforcing that nobility. I do have a lot of respect for the cunningness that they display. Garrick in particular, but mm-hmm. but Cardassians in general. They tend to kind of hang back, survey the entire situation, and find just the right angle to get what they need to do. They're not like the Klingons that come in guns blazing all the time, right? They're cunning. They hang back and they wait to find the savviest way to get that power. And we can all be like that. You know, I think all of us have been disappointed by something, whether it's career or politics or whatever, and we get agitated and we're ready to come in guns blazing. But sometimes the right thing to do is just to hang back, be a little savvier, lurk in the shadows a little bit, and then find the angle from there. And you'll find you'll make a greater impact if you do that than if you come in guns blazing. But too often we're more like the Klingons and not enough like the Cardassians in mm-hmm. this regard. I think we all could be a little bit more like Garrick and a little less like Gowron.
That is a great observation, and I think it's spot on. I think it's so true. I think for the most part, Star Trek fans loathe the Cardassians. I mean, we have them presented to us as an enemy to some degree. They are someone in the Star Trek universe not to be trusted. But I have to say that there are things that I admire about the Cardassian people. I do admire their sense of nobility. I do admire the fact, as you do, Zachary, that they have this incredible capacity for cunning, and I think there's something to be learned there. They're surgical in the way that they operate, and I think there's something very good about that. You know, very thoughtful. I find them to be a very thoughtful people, and I admire that. I admire their sense of family. I admire their ability to devote themselves to whatever it is that they value. Those are things that I find interesting. That they are virtues that I truly admire in the Cardassian people. And so I look, kind of stepping back and looking at them, I can find things about them that make them worthy of being a respected species within the Star Trek universe that I think goes beyond, you know, just loathing them and kind of the enemy of the week sort of thing. I think there's something about them to be respected and to be admired.
On the other hand, Captain Picard tells Gul Madred that he pities him. You know, he says he will always view him as that little boy, not the tall, powerful Gul Madred, but the infant inside who is lashing out at the world. And so Picard pities Gul Madred. And I think the Cardassians are worthy of pity. They have a nobility, but they're blowing it in a lot of ways. And I frankly, you can look around the world, and this is terrible because you hate to approach other people this way, but you can. You can look around the world and you go, almost everyone you can point to, even people you don't respect, have some qualities you can admire. And they have gifts. They have a nobility to them. They've got some authority. They've got whatever it is, right? And you can go, wow, I really respect that. But they're blowing it. they're not making the most of those gifts and that potential that they've got in the role that they're in. And, you know, the thing is, other people can look at you that way too, right? People can look at me and say, oh, you've got all these gifts, so you're blowing it in some ways. Sure, absolutely. We all are. This isn't meant to be overly critical, but I think it's true. The Cardassians in particular, they've got all these amazing gifts as a race and as a culture. And yet politically and in terms of intergalactic, you know, society that they live in the 24th century, they're blowing.
And they pay an incredible price for that as well.
They do. And, you know, and I think we're all like that. We all have been given some gifts. We have a lot of weaknesses. We're in certain environments and we're blowing it to some degree. We could be better than we are. And I think that self-reflection to realize is that you've got gifts, you've got failings, you're succeeding in some ways, but you're blowing it in others. If you're not thinking about that, then you're either just judging people because you don't like what they're doing, or you feel like a failure because you're not living up to your own potential. But the second you start to realize that we're all like that, we're all like the Cardassians. You know, I have a bit of gold ducat on me. I've got some nobility. I've got some gifts. I can command a room when I need to. On the other hand, I've got some failings. I haven't lived up to my potential in some ways. I've let other people down. Do I let it bother me? No, I just keep getting out of bed and doing the best I can the next day. Absolutely. It's not always easy, but that's what I do. And, you know, but I think that's also given me a very interesting combination of criticism of the world I see around me, you know, recognizing that people have gifts, but they're not living up to their potential. I want people to be better than they are and living up to their full potential. And I don't mean that harshly. You know, I think we're all like that, but if people don't realize that about themselves, that, hey, you're blowing it in some ways, do a little better, then they're not going to live up to their potential. And I think this does get to the heart of a point I made earlier that, you know, if you're not trying to be better, you're going to get worse. And I've never put it in quite those terms before, but I think the Cardassians typify that very Star Trek message, but put a unique spin on it. It's not just, let's try to get better. Let's try to be the best possible version of ourselves. It's like, no, the stakes are a little higher than that. Either you keep striving to get better, or you as an individual or we as a society will become the worse version of ourselves than we are right now.
Zachary, I think Gal Madred's reaction to what Captain Picard said and how he would view him forever and always after that moment, I think that speaks volumes for the value that Cardassia places upon the facade that they kind of present to themselves. But I will say, rest assured, Zachary, I will let the failings of the Cardassians drive me to always become the best version of myself so that I don't suffer a similar fate as the Cardassian society.
Gold Ducat's fate will not be yours, I predict.
Rest assured.
Well, Mike, it's been a lot of fun talking about Cardassian virtue ethics today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek.fm.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
It's interesting how they're doing the casting, but I think it would be nice to actually have two ships involved, because one thing that I feel Star Trek has long suffered from, even with Deep Space Nine, which did try to break out of it a bit, is that small world syndrome.
Standard orbit.
And Jim Carrey, as they're fighting, he's like singing along. He's like, brah, brah. As he's fighting, he's singing along as he's fighting Matthew Broderick. And man, it's just so good. Like, to me, that's like, when I think of Star Trek and pop culture, like, that is the one, that's the first scene that I think of in the cable guy there.
The orb.
This is another thing that we're seeing all over the world, but this whole idea that just because something is hard, we should avoid it. But that is absolutely untrue. I mean, just look at your life, look at my life, I look at anybody's life, and the things where people have learned the most have been the hard things.
To the journey!
Wait, you're saying it's like matter and antimatter when they interact? They
it's like costume and non-costume.
So costumes and non-costumes annihilate each other.
Yes.
In Voyager.
Exactly. That is how the universe is going to ultimately be destroyed, due to the interaction of naked people and people wearing clothes.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on the iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please, please leave us a star rating and a written review if you have the time. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party podcast apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link. We would absolutely love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation with us is in the Babel Conference, our listeners-only discussion group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. Hit the join button, and someone will let you right in. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select MetaTreks. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Mike, when you're not standing erect in your Kardashian uniform, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can always find me around Facebook. That's where I'm most active, certainly in the Babel Conference. I love to talk Star Trek and philosophy with our listeners there. On Twitter, you can follow me. My handle is at cmichael1701. I'm not on Instagram a whole lot, but you can catch me there, cmichael1701. If you'd like to read my blog about my personal journey to publish my novel and a little bit about life, you can catch that over at cmichael1701.wordpress.com. And Zachary, when you're not enjoying a bottle of Canard with Damar, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
It's funny you use those terms, because I am the Gul Madred of my circuses and bread. But seriously, you can find me elsewhere on the Trek FM network as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager, along with my two co-hosts there, Suzanne Williamson and Kay Shaw. You can find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give Trek FM, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm.
And the most noble of us all.
The most noble of anyone on Trek.fm. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager, and we'd like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our two associate producers here on MetaTreks, Patrick Devlin, you can find Patrick under the Twitter handle at MagicDrop5, and Kay Shaw, you can find her under the Twitter handle at ChocoWeeble. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. Also check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, we will once again boldly go where no philosophers or no Cardassians have gone before.
We're not done with the Cardassians yet.